This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. I'm so excited for today. We've got Trevor Hargreaves on the program. He is the Senior Vice President of Government Relations, Marketing, and Communications at BCREA, or the British Columbia Real Estate Association. And today is an excellent conversation.
Yeah, you know what? This is great. Past guest fan favorite. Trevor was on the show not that long ago when we were discussing the provincial election. Because Trevor, I feel like, is the go-to guy on housing when it comes to elections at any level in Canada. But we wanted to have him back on because he recently wrote an opinion piece in Business in Vancouver, 10 immediate housing policy actions for the new federal government. And that's what we discuss. And it is... It is great because not only are the policy prescriptions very smart, we rate them 1 through 10 in terms of likelihood of whether they're going to be implemented. And then we just have a general discussion around housing, the election, the kind of shifting nature of government relations with industry. And Trevor's just a super smart and super funny guy. So it's, it's a good episode.
I can't wait for this conversation. And I think people are going to have a lot of takeaways for sure. We should also mention next week, of course, we have Jordan Carlson and Michael Ferreira from Anthem joining us.
Yeah.
Which is super exciting.
Talk about a get.
I just had a great conversation with them this past week. So that's coming next week. So lots of great shows coming up. So make sure you tune in week after week. But before we get to our conversation with Trevor, Matt, of course, this episode is sponsored by Scalina Real Estate, which is our company in Vancouver. We've got a segment called it's a quiz segment and it remains nameless. That's the key.
Yeah, I got a question for you this week, Adam. It's this is a little insider baseball, but I think everybody will appreciate this. So the April stats came out about a week ago, April stats for 2025, not great in terms of sales volume. The number of properties currently listed for sale on the MLS in Metro Vancouver now stands at 16,207. And just to give you an idea, a year ago, January 2024, we had Andrew List on the program, and I remember it very well. We were somewhere around the 8,000 listed properties range, and he said, a healthy market's around 15,000. If we ever see that again, we're golden. We are now at 16,207. The question for you, Adam, is what is the percentage increase from April 2024 in terms of the number of listings to April 2025? Okay. What is the percentage increase? And I'm rounding up. So this is, we want a round number, Adam, no percentages here. But before you get to that
percentage, wait, are you asking for the percentage or are you asking?
Is it a 5% increase in listings? Is it an 85% increase in listings? What is the percentage increase year over year, April 2024 to April 2025?
Okay, but before we get to that, Matt, of course, we've got a brand new listing, and this is an incredible half duplex on the west side in prestigious Dunbar.
Right.
3337 West 40th. This is almost 2,300 square feet of living space, 5 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, built in 2020. Just unbelievable. And 1,700 square feet of outdoor space. So it's got your own private sun-drenched backyard. A phenomenal listing with an attached garage. It's available to be seen on Vancouver Real Estate Podcast Com, which is our site where we feature all of our listings.
Adam, two questions quickly, because this is an absolutely stunning listing. One, of course, you can see the photos for yourself at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. I guess that's more of a comment than a question. Two is, what is this offered at?
This is offered at $2,899,900.
That's sharp. So head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com to check out this listing as well as all our other featured listings. And while you're there, click sell with us. When you click sell with us, you can download our most downloaded PDF of all time, the sold plan, start on launch date. This is what you use to get your property ready for market. That's sell with us at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. But Adam, let's get to this quiz question. Do you remember exactly what the quiz question was?
Yes. So you're asking for basically the year over year percentage increase of active listings. Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, that was much more succinct than I put it. Yes, exactly. That's what I'm asking.
Okay. So I'm going to go with, and this is a stab in the dark. I'm just doing some mental math here. I'm going to say 30% increase.
Now I can't, did you Google this?
No. How would I have
Googled? 29.7.
Really?
I'm not, and I said I was rounding up.
Rounding up. Okay. All right. 30%.
You actually got this question right.
Well, it would make sense, right? Because we were hovering what around, trying to remember where we were. I did a calculation of where I thought we were last year. Because last year I know we were low compared to what.
Yeah. Well, and then it started spiking.
High number compared to before, and then it started spiking. So yeah, that makes sense.
So 29.7. Here's a bonus question, just very quickly for you. What is the percentage above the 10-year average for April?
Ooh. Oh, that's tough. That's tough. It's going to be lower. I'm going to go 10%, 15%.
Well, you've redeemed yourself in terms of being wildly off. It's 47.6%.
Really?
Yeah. 16,207 listings is 47.6% above the 10-year seasonal average, which is 10,979. We've had a strong 10 years. Yeah, we've had a strong... I guess my assumption is this last 10 years...
Well, we've had a low inventory for a decade, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah, that makes
sense. Hey, you got it. You bang on in one. So right. You're batting 50%. I'd take it. But maybe we should cut to our talk with Trevor Hargreaves. Again, Trevor is with BCREA. He's the Senior VP of Government Relations, Marketing, Communications. This is a great conversation.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
Adam, we want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Soane House, one of Marcon's latest communities that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced, Nordic-inspired design for architecture that endures.
Soane House offers 165 junior 1 to 3 bedroom homes in West Coquitlam, integrating nature into the built environment.
Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's marcon.ca/soenhaus, or visit the display center at Outpost in Port Moody.
We also want to highlight 102 and Park. With billions already invested in Surrey City's central development over the last 15 years, the time is now to invest in its future, Surrey 3.0.
Introducing 102 and Park, a simple, straightforward skyscraper featuring 376 homes. Quite simply, this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity coming soon to Surrey's central downtown plaza. This is the time and the place to invest. Register at marcon.ca/102andpark. That's marcon.ca/102andpark.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with Trevor Hargreaves, Senior Vice President of Government Relations, Marketing and Communications at the BC Real Estate Association. And should say second time on the show, past guest fan favorite. How you doing, Trevor?
Thank you very much for having me back. And it was a joy last time. So hopefully it's equally as enjoyable this time around.
Yeah, we're trying to get you on whenever anyone mentions the word election, and hopefully even more often than that. But I think last time, which wasn't that long ago, we had you on dissecting the NDP victory at the provincial level. Now, of course, we just had the election federally. And you wrote a really interesting opinion piece in Business in Vancouver, 10 Immediate Housing Policy Actions for the New Federal Government. So Adam and I were thinking it would be great to have you back on. So thanks for taking the time.
Thanks much. Yeah, it's been a busy few months in this country. You know, I'll be happy to take a bit of a gap with another election.
No kidding. Well, maybe for listeners who didn't hear you on the show last time, Trevor, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. My name is Trevor Hargreaves. I work for the BC Real Estate Association. We, of course, represent the 26,000 plus realtors across the province. My role, I have oversight of government relations, communications, and marketing within BCREA. And that's also inclusive of our research and policy development. So really, my main focus is around government relations, around what we're researching to talk about, the material that we're coming with, and our overall strategic approach when it comes to working with government and what it is we're communicating and pushing for on behalf of the sector. And I'll just add as well that in a realm that's so full of opinion, I'm very focused on metrics and research so that when we're coming forwards with ideas, when we're coming forwards with overall policy, it's got its own independent data behind it. Because trying to solve the housing issues before us, they need a lot less opinion and a lot more research and metrics behind them, I think.
And last time, I think we asked you this, but it's probably worth, delving into this a little bit again. But somebody out there is wondering, why does the BCREA get involved in politics, especially around election time, or even like larger questions around like housing policy and things like that? Like what is the mandate? What's behind that?
You know, I think that when it comes to housing policy in general, and in the fall we had MLAs, this has been a federal election, so we're talking about MPs. You have a lot of politicians who have constituents bursting in their door, constantly saying, "You solve this. Like, I can't buy a house. I can't buy an apartment. I can barely afford rent. I can barely afford groceries." You know, these are sizable and significant issues and legitimate issues. It's ever more challenging to live in this country. That's all fair. But I think what that has done at both provincial and federal levels of government, it has put an undue amount of pressure on those governments. They're elected in four-year cycles. When it comes to housing policy, what I would argue that has led to is a lot of policy that's being crafted and kicked out the door without being properly consulted, properly conceived. It doesn't have the proper policy research behind it. It's a lot of let's announce it from a podium and then develop it in the aftermath before it goes live. And then what you end up getting is sort of like one step forward, two steps back. You solve one issue, you cause a whole series of additional unforeseen consequences. And so for us, we don't operate alone. We operate as part of a continuum. We're working closely with a lot of other like-minded housing organizations, Canadian Home Builders, the Appraisal Institute, Mortgage Brokers Association, et cetera, et cetera. We all share a lot of information, work very collaboratively. But when it comes to why do we take very public stances around various policy pre-election, it's very much because we're trying to shape the aftermath of where housing policy goes at the end of the day. And what I want to see, what our team is constantly working towards, is fact-based decision-making, not populist politics. If you're an NDP government within this province, I don't want to see them just crafting policy that speaks to their voter base and makes them temporarily 10% more popular. I want to see policy put in place for this province that is actually going to be achievable and is going to properly assist when it comes to helping affordability, helping market stock, helping change zoning and densification policy, what have you. And the same on the federal level. What we're trying to do here is work collectively to really be research-based, to really help inform media, help inform the public and pressure public office holders at the end of the day to do a better, more detailed, careful, and collaborative job when it comes to housing policy.
And I know last time you were on and we were talking about the provincial government and what we hoped for there or what the BCREA was advocating for. But part of it was bringing back certain stakeholders into the room, essentially, right? Like listening to a more diverse range of voices. Did you find, maybe before we talk about this election, at the federal level, did you find that people were paying attention to what you guys were saying? Were they listening?
So this, for the listeners, this is a very similar ask. We asked basically the same thing to the provincial government that we just asked to the federal government. And what it is, what we want to see is the establishment of a permanent housing roundtable. And the idea is, around this roundtable, it would be at the provincial level, you know, 10 to 15 people. At the federal level, a little bit bigger, maybe 25 or 30 people, just based on size and scope and scale of policy. But it would be representative of people from the market housing side, the non-market side, indigenous voices, academic voices. You'd have some provincial and municipal representation there at the federal level, really so that when the government has a new idea, they have new policy, they don't just announce it. What you do is you take the policy to this group. You have them working under a non-disclosure agreement. They say, look, this is what we're trying to do. They distribute it in written format to them in advance. And they give all these like market policy experts the time to unpack what's being suggested, pre-vet it, pressure test it, talk about unforeseen consequences, really put it through a careful scope of analysis so that government could take careful feedback, make some changes. And by the time anything is announced, it's really had extremely detailed consultation. As to your question about how have governments picked this up, I would say that provincially, they continue to be quite resistant to this. Part of it being, I think it takes away some government autonomy. I think secondarily as well, it's just a complicated process. It'll take a lot of work to get it to do it on an ongoing basis. Federally, I would say that Carney is much more amenable to the idea. I think the federal government recognized that they need this kind of expertise to really start ongoingly crafting and announcing more workable housing policy. At the end of the day, making an ask like this, this is not just about realtors. This is about the public. This is about Canadians. This is about British Columbians. This is about crafting housing policy that actually works and gets the job done at the end of the day. And I think the truth is the expertise is beyond government. And that's the shortcoming here, is government constantly relying upon themselves. You're just talking about policy staff in Ministry of Housing departments, whereas a lot of the expertise exists in the private sector. It's the people, like the people that work in the policy department in my office, those on the ground policy experts, they're the ones that can really be sharing and working much more collaboratively with government. That's where the real insight and answers will come from, I think, at the end of the day, to really get us through a lot of these problems moving forwards.
Do you think, like, it's interesting that at the federal level, there's less pushback. Do you think that's like personality based in terms of Carney? Is it ideological? Is it because there's been 10 years of seemingly banging our head against the wall and not accomplishing as much as was at least advertised? Like why do you think they're more open to this kind of more collaborative approach?
I think even when you look at the platform that the Liberals just put forwards in the last election, it represents more of a collaborative approach. Like a lot of what they are announcing, a lot of the promises, and we'll talk about that kind of out of that top 10 list, they got those ideas from sector, right? Like those are not ideas that they've just crafted. Those are ideas that the housing sector has ongoingly been asking for. So I think they're just coming around to the reality that, hey, a lot of the most insightful policy is coming from the private sector. It's not coming from us. I think you're also seeing a time of renewal. I think you have someone like Carney come in. They are transitioning past the practices of a Trudeau government. They're looking for new ideas. He is a policy person himself, being an economist. He's looking for government to operate in a more collaborative manner, I think, in general, especially, and I think this is also true, frankly, provincially, with Trump and where things are going when it comes to the tariffs, when it comes to kind of the offshoot effect of that, which is that both the provincial government, the federal governments, they need to reinvent. They need to put much more of a focus on our provincial and domestic and national economies. They need to work with the private sector to build the private sector like never before. And so in many ways, as much as Trump has been a hindrance, he is creating and fostering a little bit of this sense of renewal, I think. And it's, I don't want to say it's not necessarily a bad thing. It is a bad thing. It's very challenging for this country, but it's also waking us up. Mm-hmm. And it's, when it comes to Canada, and what does Canada 2.0 look like moving forwards, where we are much less reliant on the US? I think that part is a positive. And if that means government work in much closer collaboration with the private sector, all the better for it at the end of the day. And it seems like it's going in that direction.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of shook us out of a, especially thinking back, kind of a long period of complacency, it feels like, in a lot of ways, which, yeah, hopefully looking back at this moment, 15, 20 years from now, we'll all be happy it happened. But time will tell. You know, I should have led with this question, Trevor, but we kind of spun off in a different direction. But can you just give us your thoughts on how the election played out? I mean, you were a keen observer. So did anything surprise you? Yeah, just general take on the way things shook out.
I mean, yeah, the whole thing was a very once-in-a-lifetime election at the end of the day, because that was Polyev's election to win several months prior, right? Trump really upended that whole scenario. I think that really, if you look back on it, you look at what happened with the conservatives, I don't think that it's anything that really was in Polyev's hands. He was really on top because the government was looking for a new perspective. But then when Trump came on the scene, when it came to where things were going with tariffs and all of these newfound challenges, you had Carney come in as a new face. And I think that new face really brought a new approach to all of the politics. And I think in order for the conservatives to remain as a contender, they would have needed someone new as well, because Poilievre was already kind of the foil to Trudeau. So leading up to that, it made it a real challenge. I think Carney has taken a very metered, calm, non-political approach in many different ways. And it's just been very interesting to see the way it played out. Now, at the same time, despite the fact that the conservatives did not win, I think it's very interesting to see a lot of the conservative gains in metro areas. They actually have a very strong showing. They picked up a lot of seats. And then simultaneously, of course, you had the federal NDP essentially collapse. And for me, as a keen observer, very housing policy oriented, and I live in New Westminster, which is, you know, three municipal levels of NDP. It's extremely NDP here. Peter Julian, our MP with 21 years of NDP background, got voted out in place of a Liberal candidate. When you see New Westminster turning against the NDP, you know things are going real bad for that
party. Yeah.
But, you know, I think that was a well-earned collapse. I think that their housing policy, you know, you saw the Liberals coming out with really detailed housing policy. The Conservatives had a lot of good ideas. Their tax reform certainly was really strong when it came to their housing policy. The NDP just really under-researched, not particularly practical. I think they've gotten way too hung up on niche issues that don't really speak to the overall electorate. They've turned themselves into a niche party by their own hand, frankly. And I think that's going to make for some major change when it comes to the landscape moving forwards, because, you know, they've lost official party status. And if they're going to continue as a party into the future, they're going to have to totally reinvent. So it'll be very interesting what happens with them. And I'm really curious to see what happens with the federal conservatives now as well, and the whole Poilievre debate, and does he stay on as leader? And I would assume so, now that it looks like he's managed to hold on to a chair with one of his MPs passing one over. But it's all very interesting times. And I mean, personally, just watching Carney in action, watching Carney yesterday meet with the president, it's all just extremely fascinating. And it's great to see a new voice right there on the ground approaching things very differently.
Yeah, I agree. What was the role this might sound like a silly question, but at the end, how big of a role do you think housing actually played in the election?
That's a good question. And it's complicated. You know, I think it's complicated in that way that you look at popular music and you go, that's the biggest band in the world right now. How much do people actually pay attention to music? You know, it's how detailed are people when it comes to the lowest comedy? You know, probably not as big of a role as as people infer. I think that, you know, I once asked my mother years ago, I remember saying to her, I'm like, why did you vote for Stephen Harper in the aftermath of the election? So you could tell, you could date how long ago this was. She said, oh, he looks nice in a sweater, you know, and I like there's popular democracy.
Yeah. Also, I'm not even sure that's accurate.
What checks a lot of boxes for people, it's not that they're like, you know, thoroughly tied to the policy. They have like one little thing. And you know, if it seems like that's working out, that's where they go. I think one of the challenges in this country, we're becoming increasingly polarized. And, you know, a lot of people, where Carney did win the election, the conservatives didn't. You still have a lot of voices saying that it's the apocalypse, Canada's over, we're totally doomed, all of these kind of things. That's identity politics at the end of the day. And that's what you see in the United States. And so I think that for a lot of people, we're getting past what were the actual core issues. We're getting much more into, I'm into a couple core concepts like fiscal conservatism, or I want Canada being a liberal democracy, you know, and you're not really digging into the details. I would say for most people, that's probably the reality. You know, I think that the housing platforms were pretty strong for the two major parties as well. They were better represented than they ever have been. But what are the hinge issues for people? I think it really just depends on the individual. And I doubt it's quite as detailed as it is for the policy wonks amongst us.
Fair enough. So maybe transitioning to this this opinion piece that you put out basically right after the election, 10 immediate housing policy actions for the new federal government. I guess two things before we start, or maybe just a quick question. How does this work? Like, I think, you know, when I was reading this, I was like, okay, this all makes a lot of sense. Are these Trevor's ideas? Are these kind of, was this a BCREA sit around the table and go, hey, let's come up with 10 ideas? How did you come up with, like, how did you come up with these prescriptions?
It was certainly not Trevor's ideas. I would say I wrote it quickly because I recognized if I got it out right after the election, they would publish it very quickly. But this was drawing from our pre-election work and largely from the Liberal platform and from the various commentary in the debates, because these are all issues where they touched upon it, where they've made vague promises in some of those directions, but they haven't really fleshed out how they're going to go about it, which is typical pre-election scenario. So I was basically trying to look at the promises that the incumbent prime minister had made. Now that they're the government, they're going to happen. They've talked about these various areas. I wrote that article to say, like, how do you take these vague promises and turn them into immediate reality? And, you know, 10, that's a lot of steps. I think one of the mistakes people make, they're always waiting for one announcement from government that's going to solve all the housing issues. That's never going to happen. What you need is 10 or 20 really good policies put into place, all working in tandem. That's where you really start to see the dial move. And that's really what that list was meant to represent, is significant change based on those promises with a lot of detail added to it.
Fantastic. So if it works for you, Trevor, I'm going to read off one by one. And what I'm hoping is you can unpack it a bit, explain exactly what you mean, why it's effective, and then one after the other, and I mean this, we'll go through one, we can rate it 1 out of 10 in terms of one being a very pessimistic view of it actually happening, and 10 being a very, you're absolutely certain it's going to take place in terms of your optimism of them taking on your policy positions.
How does that sound? I am often blamed for being overly optimistic, but yes, all right.
You're in the real estate industry. Okay, number one. So the first housing policy action, according to yourself and the BCREA, major expansion of trades education. What
this
do you mean by
like
that?
A Letterman? It sounds like a Letterman. You know, and number one,
the top 10 list, right? Yeah.
So expansion of trades education is a really interesting topic because we have two things at play here. Number one, if you look at the housing starts that the Liberals promised, they're talking about upwards of 500,000 completions a year. That is a hell of a lot of housing to build across this country. You can't just magically build that, you know, when it comes down to workers actually building it, you're going to have to dramatically expand your trades. You need more people on the ground to build that many houses. And that is a massive expansion. Now, there's a couple challenges with that, because what they have also done in recent months, and Carney has made another announcement around this since he's been elected, they're restricting immigration increasingly. So now you're not bringing in trained tradespeople into the country, new immigrants that can just go to work. Now you're cutting them back. So you got real problems here. Where is this massive growth in tradespeople coming from? So what I'm recommending there is provincial governments, using federal funding, they need to put forward major new dollars to expand trades training. And so, we're in British Columbia. BCIT is a great example in Metro Vancouver, the British Columbia Institute of Technology. Their trades programs, they are going to train and certify the kind of workers that we need moving forwards. But we need to not only expand their capabilities when it comes to how many graduates can they get through a program in a given year. The other aspect to this is creating all the kind of feeder incentivization so that when you're a new graduate graduating high school, you want to be creating grants. You want to be trying to steer students with, co-op programs where it's like you're in grade 12 and you can do like a first year course or a couple courses in an overall program while you're still in high school. You can do granting, you get scholarships. Like, let's make it easy. Let's start really incentivizing the workers of tomorrow into these programs. Because not only that, if you also look at the projected retirement rates within trades over the next decade, it's like 50% of the current workers. And so we got to move big time into trying to incentivize graduates to work. And, you can't just promise magical giant housing expansion if you don't have somebody to build the houses. That's just a real basic stopgap measure when it comes to what's been promised versus how are you going to achieve it. And interestingly, after I wrote that article, I received a message from one of the executives at BCIT basically saying, like, thanks for the shout out. Like, we're working on it, kind of thing. And, I think that's not just BCIT, of course. It's trade schools right across the province. But when you put that money in, that doesn't just magically happen. You've got to be expanding buildings. You got to be expanding curriculum. You got to be hiring teachers. That takes several years to amp up. So if they pump all the money in now, you're only getting it up to speed in like 3-4 years. So not the kind of thing you need to wait on. You got to throw money at it right away.
So I guess in terms of optimism here, maybe there's two questions. First off, it strikes me that we're in a moment where a major expansion of not necessarily trades education, but people interested in going into the trades is kind of upon us. I feel like we're at a moment where, for better or for worse, it seems younger people are skeptical of spending years in liberal arts programs and even, with the threat of AI and everything else. Are you optimistic that that young Canadians are interested in these types of jobs, maybe?
I think also part of this is if you're incentivizing it, you're giving them a reason to become increasingly optimistic. But I would say yes. I mean, if you just look at the sheer cost of a Bachelor of Arts degree now, it's so massive. When I started in the early 90s in post-secondary, I think I was paying $180 a course. Now you're lucky if you're through a BA in less than $40,000 of tuition.
Not to mention if you're actually paying rent and everything else.
Yeah, it's brutal at the end of the day. So you need to be making a spend that's going to have a return at the end of the day. And I think with trades, it's a no-brainer that you get certified, you get a job at the end of the tunnel. And these are, at the end, I sound like a politician, but these are good-paying jobs. And they're out there, the demand will be there, the promotion opportunity is there, the opportunity in a lot of these trades to start your own business in the future. If I was that age today and I was graduating high school, it's probably where I would be looking. I think it's very different than it was in the 90s and even in the 2000s. It's a place where you can find yourself some work. You go into a lot of other sectors right now, they're in decline. They're not in expansion. And it's a lot of money, again, education-wise. So it's best promised return, I would say, for your dollar. But again, government spending time incentivizing it, making it easier, making scholarships available, really giving people the reason to make those decisions. That's another big part of this, I think.
1 out of 10, 1 being that you're not very optimistic, 10 being super optimistic of the Liberal government taking your advice.
I would say I'm pretty optimistic. I'm going to give this like an 8. We were talking just pre-interview a little bit about how in LinkedIn, you're seeing like a lot of vitriolic dialogue often going back and forth lately. But
LinkedIn's the new Twitter or new X.
Yeah. People are not behaving quite as with the same corporate restraint that they once did. But, you know, you want to make those housing starts. You've got to make this spend. And one of the major criticisms that I find a lot of Carney critics are making right now is that like, oh, he's going to be like the biggest record governmental spender in history. You know, and I know the Liberals have a major spending problem, but if you don't spend this kind of money to get this done, you're not making those housing starts. So, yeah. You know, I think that's like a first and foremost investment that needs to be made when it comes to housing, or you literally don't have the capacity to expand your housing. So it's a no-brainer, I think, at the end of the day.
Number 2, invest in prefabricated and modular housing.
I feel like we need someone to play it in now with an orchestra.
It's Paul like, right, Schaefer. We right need Paul Schaefer yeah. here.
little piano number before we go into number 2. Rising with a Bullet. It's number 2. Yeah, so prefab's really interesting as well. And this is an extension of what we just talked about. You got a major trade shortage. In the future, they're trying to make, you know, 500,000 homes in a given year. You're trying to hire tradespeople. If you're moving forwards to using prefabricated materials, number one, that's a sector that it's not that it doesn't exist. It's out there. It's in startup mode actively, but it's struggling because, you know, zoning needs to be changed. Inspection models need to be changed. Government need to really embrace this technology and incentivize it. But if you move it at scale, A, it creates a whole lot of new domestic jobs. Secondarily, it actually enables you to make projects much faster because it's prefabricated. It's coming to the site. You know, you're not shipping a whole house, but you're shipping it in large pre-built sections so that it can all be put together much quicker. The other major spin-off effect of this is that when you are straining with labor, you can then move forwards and hire some less trained and less skilled tradespeople to work on assembling the prefabricated materials because they're not starting from scratch. And so it's not to say that you're replacing all the skilled trades labor, but it creates kind of a lower tier of trades labor, which again, makes it easy to do that hiring to get it up to scale. And so a lot of what we're talking about here is trying to massively expand housing in a very short amount of time using a series of methods. This is basically technological innovation to do it. Other countries do it in much more scale than we do. China is a good example. It's a smart way to go. We're trying to put a focus on where do you go with the Canadian economy as well. This is a whole burgeoning sector that could be worth billions and billions of dollars. Major hiring. It could also involve a lot of exports once these materials are built out. It has a lot of promise. I think there's a lot of interest in it with the current government as well. I'd say it's a pretty, you know, it's very likely they're going in this direction to be working hard to incentivize it.
1 through 10, Trevor.
Giving it another 8.
Okay. Is an 80%, is that an A or a B plus? Are we working with grade inflation here?
It's a challenging one because like I could say with almost 100% likelihood, they're going to throw money at it. It's more a question of how successful is it in becoming a burgeoning industry.
Right.
That's kind of out of my scope. I don't know. But I think that I've sat through some various presentations when it comes to this technology, the materials, the promises moving forwards. It's a very logical avenue to move in and will be a very interesting change within the housing sector should it continue to advance. I think it will. I think it's a given. It's really just a question of scale and how dramatic will the scale up be.
Right. Number 3, we've talked about establish a permanent national housing policy roundtable. And just for anyone listening, that's that group of 20 to 25 stakeholders from various angles of the housing world come together and steel man any sort of policy before it gets put forward. Have you been invited? And what is your rating from 1 to 10 in terms of if this is going to happen?
We're continuing to push this on the provincial level. There is a lot of work with our federal body as we continue to push this we're pushing it at the provincial level. Our federal body, CREA, are pushing it at the national level. We're really working in collaboration. This one I don't know. You know, it's a challenge as to how they move forwards. The way that this would work is It's not, you know, it's advising government. It's not dictating anything.
Right.
We're not giving these people powers. We're really just using them to unpack these potential new policies. My statement that I have long said is I don't even care if BCREA have a seat at that table. What I care about is that that table is there. You know, we need that mechanism. I'd say I'm 60% on this one, mainly because there's a lot of what ifs, and I think it will happen eventually. I just don't know if it'll happen this year, or it might take a few more years to get there. We're continuing to make the push provincially as well. I think it's something that will come out of necessity sooner or later.
You know, and I think we talked about this last time when we were talking about the NDP not adopting this, but, you know, it does, it's that team of rivals idea that Obama, I think, stole from Abraham Lincoln or something like that. But basically getting the smartest people in the room. And the one thing that makes me think it could, I guess this isn't an advisory board that would be sitting with Mark Carney, but he does strike me as a guy who is not intimidated by a bunch of smart people sitting around the table and him making the final decision. This, like, you know what I mean? Some people, it strikes me as not every leader would be keen to get this group together, but I don't know. Seems like it could be an interesting thing.
Before I worked in organized real estate, I have a background. I worked kind of in the dairy lobby segment for a long time. I had a lot of NAFTA proximity, kind of right at the end of NAFTA negotiations. I was very heavily involved on the dairy side on my way up. So I still have a lot of connections when it comes to the senior levels of Ottawa, kind of on the bureaucratic side. But I've heard some interesting feedback about Carney and what he's like and what a smart but detailed and hard-nosed businessman he is. You know, and if he allows 30 minutes for a meeting, it's 30 minutes. Like, it's not going to be 31 minutes. Like, you're in, you focus. If one person makes reference to something, then the next person better not waste tying back to it and being repetitive. Like, he's very focused and detailed and policy-driven and experienced. And, you know, if that is all true, I think that serves very well. That's very interesting to see someone that is used to essentially private sector leadership running a country, because that's like hiring a CEO at the end of the day to run a country. And it'll be interesting to see. I think he's soft-spoken, but I don't think behind the scenes that's the way he operates. I think he's a firm player and a very smart man.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible. This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Events Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new Tennis Center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a Caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia,
serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakland, please reach out to us at oakland.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Number 4, Trevor, federal assistance with development cost charges, or DCCs. This has been a hot button topic for a while. Can you unpack it?
It's an interesting one because that's one where I did diversify a little bit from the Liberal platform. And I threw something in that's a very Vancouver and British Columbia centric issue. Development cost charges and amenity cost charges when it comes to new builds and primarily around condos, because that's the bulk of what's getting built in Metro Vancouver. Whenever you're building these new buildings, the developer is saddled with these charges, which are essentially infrastructural charges, because a municipality, it costs them money. It costs them money to further develop their sewage, their electrical, you know, all the overall infrastructure to be adding and densifying within a community. The other cost is ACCs, which is amenity costs, which is where you're spending money on pools and parks and overall services as you're densifying your community. Now, one of the real challenges that we've had over the past couple of years, the provincial government really operated quick and hard in terms of changing zoning policy, giving housing targets to communities and municipalities, and really just changing things quite dramatically and putting a lot of pressure on municipalities. As the municipalities are grappling with this sudden densification, they're looking at all of these development cost charges and going, oh, we're going to have like a bunch more costs. What do we do? What do we do? And what they've done is more often than not, they've tried to just burden the developer with the DCC charges and be like, oh, well, we're going to double the DCC cost and we're just going to make the developer pay it. And that, number one, we have a bad attitude, I think, when it comes to how we look at developers, or at least how the public and the government treat developers. It's almost like you're going to make a profit, so you're a bad guy. Like, you're a private business. You're there for a reason. You're investing a lot of speculative money. You're adopting a lot of risk. You're putting in a lot of effort. These are multi-year projects. These are businesses that should be treated with respect. And we're not in the USSR. You know, companies can be expected to make some profit. But what has happened is a lot of these developers have been burdened with very unreasonable development cost charge fees to the point where it challenges the overall cost mechanisms of the project. And what happens is that either stalls the project out, and at a time where we're trying to get more housing as quickly as possible, we do not want to be taking a whole bunch of potential projects and then suddenly putting them on hold. Or the other side of that is they get saddled with all of these costs, which the developer then has to, in turn, pass on to the consumer, the eventual buyer. And that's not a win either, because now you just have the government, whatever the layer of government, the municipal layer of government, passing costs on to the developer, and the developer is just charging more for the end product condo to make their costs back. None of that is a win. DCCs are a problem. We want to be incentivizing developers. We want to have developers happy to work in British Columbia. We want to streamline their projects, lessen red tape, look at really vital projects and try to get them built as quickly as possible. So as part of that, when it comes to DCCs, this needs to get off the back of developers at the end of the day. And we need to find better ways to deal with our amenity costs and our development cost charges. And there's been a long-standing saying, you know, development pays for development. I don't really believe that personally. I think that development needs to be paid for in other ways. And especially because we're in a market that's so skewed already, it's so damn expensive. We need to find other ways to pay for these amenity costs and development costs. And so the federal government made some vague promises about trying to support municipalities, trying to offset some of these costs. I think it's safe to say they're going to do so, but I can tell you that's going to have a hell of a price tag attached to it. You're talking billions of dollars at the end of the day.
Yeah. So from 1 to 10, it sounds like you're actually optimistic that the feds are stepping in.
It's arguably the biggest challenge to the housing sector in this province, I would say. You have housing starts that are down over the past year from the year prior at the very time that they should be way up. And I would argue that that is largely based on DCCs. And of course, that's just DCCs. That's not even talking about amenity costs, which is a whole separate spinoff issue, which I have great concern around because, you know, we work in a sector focused around selling houses. When you're densifying communities, that's something that we can be behind. But I think very much what overall the province needs to be very focused on is logical, smart, sustainable densification. And you can't be adding all these people to municipalities without making sure the amenities are there. And so that also requires a lot of funds. And we got problems in this country that, you know, you can't vastly densify in very short amounts of time without there being a bunch of unintended consequences. And the development costs and the amenity costs are one of the consequences. How do you amortize that over a short amount of time? And again, you know, when the Liberal government are about to take ongoing criticism around their spending, if we want to move things quicker, they're going to have to spend a lot to try to help move this forwards.
So you're giving it a number?
I'm giving it a 10. I think that this is going to be one of their first and foremost. I guess I should give it a 9 since I'm not directly.
You know what? I've taken notes. That was a 10. I'm going to put 10. I'm putting 10 there.
I mean, it's a quick necessity to getting houses built in this province again at the rate that we need to get them built. So I think it's going to happen. They've made the promise on the platform. I think it's got to be greenlit. They just have to figure out the details moving forward.
Number 5, reintroduce MURB.
MURB. Yeah. So
it's been brought up a few times on the show, but for the uninitiated, can you also tell us what MURB is?
So MURB goes back to the 1970s, where Canada was in a process of extreme industrial expansion. There was a lot of business infrastructure being built. Our population was quickly expanding. Urban areas were very quickly densifying. The MURB program was put into place. It stands for the Multi-Unit Rental Building Program. And it was basically a tax incentive for builders. When it was in place, it inspired the creation of over 200,000 units. The program ran, I think, from 1974 to 1981. So it was in place for quite a while. The basic way that this operated is it was incentivizing building new rental projects so that the owners of these projects, where they would be making less income or introducing new rental building, either at market or particularly below market, they could draw the income losses for introducing below market housing. They could draw that as tax deductions at the end of the day. So it was something that was extremely expensive to government in terms of lost taxation revenue when they were incentivizing this program, which is essentially why they ended up canceling the program. But it really did incentivize market or below market housing being built at scale in a very short amount of time. Now, what's happened is in recent years, we're looking at a bit of a repeat situation where you're saying, like, this is a really needed aspect where we're not talking about, you know, products or housing that's condos for sale, but rather rental buildings or below market, you know, specialized buildings as well. We need a lot of this. It's an increased demand for a variety of segments of demographics that live in Metro Vancouver and right across the country. We don't just need one or two buildings. We need it at scale. We need a whole lot. This is a program that would incentivize getting that done. And it would give very deep, again, tax incentives to developers to actually move forwards and make that option as a route to go, because otherwise they don't. They've been moving forwards to build buildings so that they can sell them, you know, as new sales and condos. So I would say with this one, it's something that the sector has been suggesting and asking for many years. I think this is a really good example of government listening to the private sector, listening to the construction sector, listening to the policy people within the housing environment, and implementing some new innovative ideas. I think this one, it can be a real game changer, but again, it'll be real expensive to implement.
So with the federal assistance, with the DCCs being a 10, you've mentioned more than once the expensive nature of MURB. What are you giving this, 1 through 10?
I think it has the effect to be super effective. Like it would be super expensive, but it would really get the job done. I mean, they've sounded it out within the platform. Let's say 60 to 70% likelihood over the next 4 years.
I'm giving it a 6.5.
My concern is that with each of these, you go through them and it's not that they're bad ideas. They're great ideas and they can move the dial. And, you know, when people throw rocks at the housing policy of the Liberals, I'm like, well, slow down a little. Like, these are insightful ideas. This is bold, smart stuff. And they're not just sort of throwing it out on a platform. This indicates careful research, putting that on there and listening to other voices. But again, you're talking billions and billions of dollars in lost tax revenue when you're going in that angle. So it just becomes a case of how much can they spend and to implement all of these big, bold ideas.
Number 6, tax reform.
Tax reform is a bit of a more vague scenario, but as we look at a Trumpian atmosphere, We look at the review of our country. We look at trying to drop interprovincial borders, try to become more effective as Canadian business operates. Canadian taxes are just very onerous. We have a lot of repetitive taxes or duplicate taxes federally to provincially. What we would just like to see is a step right back and a fulsome review of all housing taxation at the federal level, juxtaposed against the taxation at the provincial level, so that we can be looking at where can streamlining be operated, what kind of efficiencies can be put into place, what kind of policies and taxes can be repealed, and how can we really be incentivizing and making it more effective when it comes to Canadian taxation, because this is a rough country when it comes to taxes, and particularly within the housing sector.
Well, and GST on new construction was a big part of the platform. Is that something? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so there was two differences. The Liberals spoke to first-time homebuyers or buying a new property up to $1 million being exempted from GST. The Conservatives, I thought, actually had the better proposal, which was up to $1.3 million, which I thought was a little bit more representative. You know, the Metro, Vancouver, and Toronto areas where it counts. Like, that's much more representative of a new build. And, you know, I think that's a very logical one. You've got both parties that pushed it forwards. I think it's pretty likely they're going to go that avenue. It's a fairly low-hanging fruit. It means a savings both to builders, because the actual GST exemptions are on a lot of the upfront materials, but it ends up being that translates into a saving for the buyer. And so at the liberal amount of $1 million, that's about 53,000-54,000 that the buyer would potentially save. At 1.3 million, you're talking 68,000-69,000, right around there. It's a sizable chunk of change. And I think there's an offshoot value to that as well, because if you're containing costs using this tax measure, that's going to lower the end price of new builds, which in turn is going to help contain the price of older properties being put up for sale, because they need to be competitive against these new builds.
Sure.
So it seems like a win that has multiple levels of kind of thumbs up pro positive outcome if it's to be implemented. So I think when it comes to immediate tax reform, that's a really good one that they could put into place.
It was in both platforms, the Conservative and the Liberals, I guess, with the differing amounts from 1 to 10 on this one, Trevor. What do you think?
I think this one, it's an easier one for them to implement, because yes, it's a bit of a tax hit, but at least it's not logistically super, you know, you want to put MERB into place, that's going to be real complicated. For this one, it's not so difficult. So I think this one's a 10. I think they're going to put it in, and they'll put it in soon, because it's actually, they can show some pragmatic steps forwards right away. And by implementing this, it's a quick one. I figure this is in place by 2026.
Number 7, policy review.
Again, it's a bit of a more vague statement, but when it comes to housing policy, we talked about this a little bit earlier, the fact that, you know, governments have been pressured to make a lot of announcements. They sound good from a podium, but they aren't necessarily really well thought out. Then you have ideas where they weren't that well thought out, and they've been sitting there operating for multiple years, and are they even achieving the originally stated goals? Is anyone taking the time to do this analysis? Are they repealing things if they don't work? You know, pushing government to really stop, look at everything that you've put into place, do a fresh review of all of it, look at the efficacy, and repeal some of these things when they don't work. And one of the ones that really kind of I see as a problematic policy that they put into place is the federal foreign homebuyer ban. If you look at the total number of statistics of home sales going to foreign buyers across the country, they made an announcement that was affecting less than 1.3% of the market. So what were you expecting to achieve by making that announcement to begin with? Like, the most like cursory research would have told you you're not making, at best you just affected 1.3%.
Like, yeah.
It's not a major move. When they've implemented that policy, they've made a series of sizable gaffes, and it's caused some problems within British Columbia. For example, there's several ski municipalities that were covered under this blanket ban because they're incorporated as a municipality. So Sun Peaks, for example, is incorporated as a municipality. So the foreign homebuyer ban encapsulates Sun Peaks. So you've got several ski hills across the province who are already reeling, trying to recover from the COVID years. Now you're just banning foreign investment on condos on a ski hill that are not for permanent occupancy anyway. So they've made those mistakes while providing exemptions to places like Whistler. It's none of it's helpful. None of it was really meaningful policy to begin with. These are the kind of things. Stop, do your homework, actually work out the metrics. Is this stuff working? And if it isn't, get rid of it, because we don't need a less is more, all kind of policies all over the place scenario. We just need policies that are working. And we'd like to see them just stop and review everything that's been put into place over the last 5 years.
So, you know, if the Conservatives won a majority, you would think, okay, that's definitely, you know, the first step, right? You go back and you start repealing. 1 through 10 here on the situation that we're in. Do you think they're going back and changing a lot of the stuff the Liberals put in place over the last decade?
I think it remains to be seen what Carney's perspective is and who the new housing minister ends up being. Is that Sean Fraser coming back? I don't really know at this point. But 50-50, I'd say. I think it really depends on... They've got a lot of new ideas and their focus is probably moving forwards. But, you know, this would be a sound way that they could look at what they're already doing and take a fresh start.
We're getting to the end here, Trevor. Number 8, homelessness.
Homelessness I threw in there because I thought it was interesting within the Liberal platform. You're talking about all these different things, all kinds of detailed ideas. I thought MERB was really progressive. And yet there was very little discussion around homelessness. And, you know, I was in Ottawa last October, and I thought it was really interesting that, you know, we're taking meetings in Parliament. I'm a block away and there's people sleeping on steam grates a block away from Parliament. And I found that to be a very just jarring moment where you're, you know, here you are, the base of operations of your country with an outward homelessness problem all surrounding where government is operating out of. And I was stricken with the fact that this isn't good enough, you know. And as I wrote in that article, we're a G7 country. This has been a spiraling issue for years. We need to find solutions to this, and not a Band-Aid fix, but outward fixes. And I think if Carney wants to come at things as a fresh, strong leader, you have municipalities that are very dedicated to trying to find solutions. You have provincial leadership very dedicated, but this is outside of their scope. At the end of the day, this needs strong federal policy leadership and money. And, you know, doing what we do, I think we can be all too focused on market realities and the business aspect of the housing spectrum. I think if we're going to pick apart housing, like, let's get people who need houses, and nobody should be sleeping in alleys and on grates within this country. And if that's okay for people, I think they need to shake their head and think better. And I think with a new leader coming in and a new approach, that's something that if we're going to make this a better country moving forwards, and we're going to try to make Canada a more livable environment, we need to get people off the streets.
The chance that it happens, 1 through 10.
I have no idea. It wasn't in their policy platform, but you know, it's articles like that that when you write them quickly, you know, you have a really good odd of getting out there, and that's going to land on, you know, the planning office within Carney's department, within the housing ministry. And so I write things like that because, I mean, I truly believe it. I'm just trying to use my role and my experience in policy to try to push for better when I can. I'm not super optimistic. I would like to be, but I think that's one of those issues we have just seen be getting worse and worse. And I think it needs some really radical focus.
Would you say 5?
Let's say 5.
Kind of in the same vein, although not entirely. Number 9, affordable housing. So, you know, some people would say, well, wait a second, the DCC charges will hopefully lead to costs coming down. MERB is hopefully going to lead to more affordable housing. But you did have one of the 10 precious spots for affordable housing. How was it different? What'd you mean?
I was trying to be holistic in this as well. You know, again, so I'm not just giving feedback. That's why I added that homelessness section. So that what we're talking about is the whole spectrum of housing, the concept of housing, because, you know, that's one of the things that kept the NDP down. They were focused in their one little aspect of policy. The Conservatives are very focused on the business side of things. The Liberals, as a relatively centrist government at this point in time, you know, and they are the government in power, they need to be coming up with solutions basically for all Canadians. So what I was talking about when I added affordable housing, I was talking about expansion of grants and loans for specific high-need housing demographics. And so aside, obviously, from the homeless, we're talking about demographics that are just economically really struggling, supportive housing, emergency shelters, expanded student housing, which is something that's in very short supply and ever more challenged amidst low rental rates within metro areas, and targeted expansion of senior housing as well, because that's another segment where the retirement population and the boomers aging, there's going to be an explosion of need for senior housing in coming years that it's questionable as to whether or not any of that is being addressed at size and scale as it needs to be. And it's the kind of thing where you can't just suddenly get caught out and go, oh, how do we deal with it? Because you deal with it over 10 years of careful policy planning and building. And the time to be doing that is now. So I wanted to add that in. That's, you know, credit to other people's work very often, where I'm educated on these subjects from reading their work and from reading nonprofit organizations and their research. So I try to be holistic in that article, which is why I threw that in. Because again, how else do you best represent Canadians than focusing in areas like that?
Yeah, no, fair enough. Optimism score?
Again, it remains to be seen. I'm sure they'll do better in some categories rather than others, but why don't we give it a 6 out of 10?
Okay. And the last but not least, and I mean this genuinely, because this is one that I think everybody can agree on. Work more collectively as three layers of government in cohesive partnership. What do you mean?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that the last few years, you've had the provincial government under David Eby really ramrodding through a lot of, as I mentioned earlier, like a lot of change, rezoning, housing targets, all of these things, throwing municipalities into a bit of a state of disarray at times as they try to figure out, like, how are we supposed to move quickly enough? You know, municipal government are not known for moving quickly. And smaller municipal governments are often staffed with people that have been there for 30 years. You know, they're not quick, immediate, best practice yeah. kind of people. Which is not to, don't take that as a blanket offense.
Just a fact.
Municipal listeners, but you know, it can be the case. So to come at them with these like progressive goals with kind of no warning and no collaboration has been very challenging for certain areas. So you got the province going in that avenue. You've got provinces acting differently and not particularly collaborating on each other. I have seen bad policy put into place that hasn't been properly researched provincially, put into place in British Columbia. And then Ontario look at that policy 6 months later and go, hey, what's that progressive thing they're doing in BC? Let's adopt that. You know, like that's not good. The municipalities need to work much or be much more closely consulted and worked with when it comes to the province. Provinces need to really work and have a collective say working with each other and sharing ideas and approaches and similar policy where they can. And then the federal government needs to show leadership. And this needs to operate much more as one big cohesive pie so that it's three tiers, but everybody's part of the same team and essentially working for the same corporation. And I think we have seen at times the federal government looking to make a regional housing announcement. They're gonna hold a press release in Vancouver and then they call it off because Vancouver is making a municipal announcement that's the antithesis of what they're about to announce. And it's all chaos. Like they're at times, like they've actively been working against each other. And we're all just taxpayers in this country. We're amidst a housing crisis. Like, get your act in order. And I think that starts with the federal government. They're the boss, you know, they're the top desk and it's a top-down scenario. They're the ones that should be making sure that structures are in place to have the kind of oversight and collaboration that you need to properly run this country, to properly organize the tiers of government, and to get the job done at the end of the day.
Well, you know, and this kind of, it's different, but it makes me think of all the kind of strengthening trade relationships across the country and making sure that if you're in one profession in BC, you can move to Alberta or wherever else. You want, I mean, this is kind of in the same vein. Like you said, it's time to get your act together. Like, let's get all on the same page and start pulling in the same direction. As an optimism score, and this is your last score, so think carefully. And this is a big ask. This is a big ask as well.
Yeah, like there will be steps in the right direction. Will they wholesomely achieve this? I doubt it, but I think it'll be better than it's been. I think, again, the necessity of Trump or the necessity of reinventing under Trump's shadow puts additional pressure on government to just be a more effective operation. This entire country needs to be a more effective operation moving forwards. And so I think out of necessity, strong steps are going to be taken to that degree. So I'm optimistic there will be positive steps over the Carney administration. I'll give that a, let's say, an 80%.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, I'm not saying that at the end of the administration is going to be a harmonious, perfect three layers of government, but I think they'll get to the point where they're not tripping over each other's feet and mayors are super mad at the premier and are calling out things that the provincial government are announcing and the provinces aren't supportive of housing measures that are federal, et cetera, et cetera. Like I think we're going to have a more cohesive approach and there's room for the dust to settle and for everybody to get a bit better organized.
The total score, Trevor, was 72.5. Reminds me of my high school grades.
I was going to say, it reminds me of mine.
And that's not saying much, but I do feel like my general take here from our conversation is, and I should say, in especially in relation to a lot of people we've had on the show lately, you seem quite optimistic about the future of the country right now.
I'll say as well, you know, I had a hard time deciding how to vote. I actually got to meet Carney the week before the election very briefly. I went to one of his rallies just to see the guy. I've seen Polyev speak. I'd never seen Carney. And I didn't think that there was a magic bullet party here. It was a challenging scenario, but I think that he brings a much needed new voice, a new approach. I don't love the fact that it's still the same party in place that was responsible for a lot of the problems before. But again, a new leader can be very transformative. And we're talking specifically about housing policy today, and they brought a lot of good policy ideas to the table that I've just expanded upon in this article. So I'm optimistic that when it comes to housing policy, you enact a bunch of the things we're talking about today, you're going to get a lot more done than has been done over the last 4 years.
That's a good place to leave it. We do have this segment called the Five Wire Trevor Five Lighthearted Questions. I made some changes from the last time you were on because you were on fairly recently. Do you have time to stick around for that?
Lay it on me.
The Five Wire is brought to you by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been recognized as Multifamily Home Builder of the Year for 10 years in a row and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with 2 fitness areas, 3 children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
All right, one of them is the same. Just because I strike me as a prolific reader. One book you have read recently that you'd recommend to all our listeners?
It is a book by the tambourinist of the band, the Brian Jonestown Massacre, about this sort of shambolic experience of that band.
That actually sounds unbelievable.
Well, you're used to hearing, you know, it's the bassist or the incredibly talented lead singer or solo guitar. So it's just the guy that, you know, does the tambourine. So it's kind of a hilarious read. And so I've been reading. I'm sorry, the name escapes me as to what the name of the book is, but I'm always big on mixing my politics with music autobiography.
It's a good story. Like it's a well-written book.
It's gripping, in fact. It's kind of in that way that it's hard to look away from a train wreck.
I'm in.
That's a 10 out of 10. It was recommended to me, and I've been quite enjoying it.
Right on. What's a restaurant in Metro Vancouver that you think more people should know about?
Fable. I went in there last Friday and it was like right after work. The place should have been like overwhelmed with business, but it has a great patio. The food was great. The service was great. And it was quiet in there and it's like right downtown. So check it out.
All right. That's a good one. I think we asked you this last time because I've been going down a justified watch for a while here, but and I think that was your pick. What have you been binge watching lately, or a favorite movie or movie recommendation?
My 16-year-old, well, 15, but about to turn 16-year-old son sold me on this show and I didn't believe him, but he was like, I was watching this. You got to see it. Like, let's start it back at episode one. Tulsa King, which stars Sylvester Stallone, about a 25-year-old or a 25-year ex-con. So he's been in prison for 25 years. He gets out of jail. He goes back to like the mob that he was working for in New York and he gets relocated to Tulsa. And starts about this whole sort of crime empire, starting with a legalized marijuana store. And it's funny, it's entertaining, and it's just a great watch. There's two seasons, and it's a great watch from beginning to end.
Wow, I don't think I've even heard of that one. So that's
and I would have never watched, like, Sylvester Stallone is not going to draw, other than Rambo, he's not going to draw me to a new show. I wouldn't have believed it. I was very skeptical, but he's great. He's completely hilarious. It's well cast. It's totally entertaining. It's kind of in the avenue of The Sopranos as well. Like, it has its like hard hitting crime moments, but it's a great watch.
Fantastic. What's a strong opinion you held 5 years ago that has completely changed today?
Boy, that's the one you're supposed to email me a week in advance so I can sit up every night trying to. I was reflecting when we were just talking about the election, where it was like, wow, it's crazy times. It's crazy times. And, you know, you look at COVID and we were like, wow, it's crazy times. It's crazy times. Yeah. Now you look at now, it's like, it's crazy times. It's crazy times. So I think like my opinion would be like, you know, life is fairly predictable. And no, it ain't. That is probably, I think, where my opinion currently sits. We have a talk show, an unqualified talk show host for a president, you know, essentially. Oh,
I thought you were talking about me at first.
reinventing democracy next door to us. We have, we're coming out of multiple years of living indoors from a plague. Like, who the hell knows what's next? Alien invasion? Like, it's creative days the last few years.
Yeah, you know what? It's true. I feel like everyone, I've heard this a million times, but if this was a movie the last 5 years, you wouldn't have believed it. If it came out in like 98 or something like that,
you would also send the script back for better character revision to make the characters more detailed and believable. But I don't know. And this is not how I pictured being an adult. You know, I didn't think I was coming into like the plague years followed by the war with your neighbors.
It was pretty stable there for a while.
It's a little odd. It's
coming up. Yeah. Last but not least, Trevor, and we appreciate your time. If you had to start your career over in a completely different industry, what would you choose?
Geez, I think I would go into the trades sector and get into prefabricated housing.
Commercial plumbing it is. Okay.
Yeah, commercial plumbing or electrical, I think, is probably the truth. That's where the money is, man.
Like you said, the ability to start your own business is a really exciting kind of component of there. There's kind of a, not that it would be easy, but there's a clear path. You know, it's a fairly established line to something you could scale. So, no, that's great. Well, thank you again for your time, Trevor. The article was in Business in Vancouver. How can people find out more about what you're up to? I would say follow along on LinkedIn because you're fighting the good fight over there. But how else can people find out what you and the BCREA are up to?
Yeah, I'm struggling when it comes to LinkedIn lately because, as we said, it's ever more kind of vitriolic and overly opinionated. And you're trying to behave yourself in a corporate manner, not get into these like stupid ideological debates with people. But it's a strangely evolving atmosphere there. Yeah, when it comes to my writing, I write frequently for the BIV as well as the ORCA, which is sort of the BIV's political offshoot. You can always go to the advocacy page or just the main website at bcrea.ca or check out the ever entertaining narrative and back and forth on my LinkedIn. page, which, you know, I think there's a lot to talk about on an ongoing basis. And I try to chime in on topical issues and inspire feedback from people. And I find it a very interesting forum these days. It's a little bit less toxic.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for your time. And I'm not sure there's an election coming up too soon, but we'll have to have you back on as soon as you have the time.
Yeah, I'll see you in the municipal election.
Right, thanks, Trevor.
All right. See you next time.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Trevor Hargreaves, Senior Vice President, Government Relations, Marketing and Communications at the BCREA.
You know, it's always great having Trevor on the program. Unfortunately, I had to miss this conversation, but I'm going to go back and listen to it because, I mean, honestly, first of all, BCREA, what a phenomenal team of intelligent individuals. They're kind of helping the industry collectively move forward. And also, the other thing that's amazing about it is, so many great ideas around policy coming out of the real estate industry. And it's not surprising to me, but people that generally want to help all the stakeholders involved make this a better market for everyone, right? So super excited.
Yeah. And you know, a thing about that conversation, two things struck me. One is that Trevor's, and this is a very different tone than the one he struck in regards to the provincial NDP. His impression is the federal Liberals are very much interested in working with industry in a way that others have not for quite some time, which is exciting. And he's pretty optimistic about a lot of the changes he's proposing, that a lot of them are going to happen, and it's going to kind of, you know, get this logjam sorted out in housing. So kind of an optimistic call. It was a fun one to be a part of. And of course, yeah, Trevor's just a super intelligent and funny guy. So it was great talking to him.
But before we cut for the day, Matt, we've got a couple things. Of course, we have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Absolutely, Adam. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for all things real estate related. Things like the Livewire. This is our weekly mailer where you get VIP access to pre-sales. You get deal of the month. You get stats, different types of stats. You get sales ratios every month where you can dig into your neighborhood, the price band where your property falls or a property that you're interested in, or just market in general. But you can really go nitty gritty with those stats and you can't find them anywhere else. That's all on the Livewire. You sign up for that at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And of course, we also have tried and true private client services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using PCS, you're standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is the best way to monitor listings in Vancouver. So if you are a buyer or even someone that owns a property and you just want to monitor the market, set up your own free account. And again, you get realtor level information from this tool, sold prices in real time. It's phenomenal. So sign up at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And Matt, if anyone wants to talk to you about anything real estate related, how can they get in touch?
You can get in touch with me at any time, 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we have that Kokomo line, info at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, everyone. And we're back next week with Michael Ferreira and Jordan Carlson from Anthem Properties. I cannot wait for this episode.
Absolute banger. Have a good week.
2,000 Faces for Radio.
Subscribe today.